Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted podcast host. I'm here with Melinda Martin. Why don't you give us an introduction and focus on why we should trust you?
Ooh. I really like that question because one thing that I do with my clients is we talk about the trust fall because that has to happen at any point where you hire someone to do any project. To avoid treating them like a screwdriver. So what I do is I'm a publishing facilitator and a book designer. So I help people who publish children's books, business books, fiction books, basically any book that I feel that I'm a good partner for. I take them under my wing. I answer all the questions and I evaluate where they want to end up. In combination with their budget. And then I help form a path to get them there, if possible. Sometimes people's goals are bigger than their budgets, but there are solutions for that as well. And I just help with all of it. So they should trust me because I've been doing this for over 15 years. But aside from that, because I think it's it's common, like, just because you've been doing something for a long time doesn't mean you're any good at it. And I think, you know, we all know those people like, oh, I've been in this industry for 20 years. I'm like, well, your work sucks. Like, you've been in it 20 years and your work is still this bad. so many people in the publishing business, the publishing industry, they started a publishing business because they see it as a cash cow. They play on people's emotions, and it is such a predatory industry. And I did not start this business. I really didn't even set out to start a business. The business just kind of found me. And so it's been an organic growth over the 15 years. And it is really my passion. I mean, there's lots of other things I could be doing to make more money, but this is the nerd in me, the book lover in me, the helper in me just has found a very happy home with helping authors that I get along with, that we're a good fit for, right? I'm not the best fit for everybody because I am very direct. Not everybody likes that. and so when I am a good fit for someone, then we work hard at being a great team and publishing a quality book for their audience.
So does it matter if they have like a tragic backstory, or does it have to be, you know, oh, I went through 4 years in rehab and I struggled for all this time, or how important is the tragic aspect of their story, or is it more about just being authentic and communicating like what they went through in their niche that leads to successful books?
Well, everybody loves a good tragedy, right? I mean, we're drawn to the accident on the side of the road. Like, I don't know why people can't just still drive 70 miles an hour past the accident, but everybody has to stop and gawk, and that's just the human experience. And so I think it depends on, not everybody wants to rehash their tragedy, right? I feel like most people have tragedy, and if they're not, like, I need to talk to that person and figure out how they've escaped life without tragedy. But it takes a special kind of person to really want to continue to talk about that tragedy all the time, to be able to get to a place where they are using their book as a platform for speaking about tragedy, for helping others advocate in their arena that the tragedy occurred. Like my husband, for example, he was a death row chaplain for the Texas prison system. And so has been considering writing a book. He has started writing a book because, as you can imagine, there is a lot to seeing people die every Tuesday. whether you agree with it or not, when it's your job to be there as a chaplain to the offender's family, you do what you need to do to show up for those people. Because it's not about you, it's about them. But as he started writing the book, he was like, I just don't think I want to keep writing this book. You know, it's a lot to go through, to relive emotionally, that he witnessed over, I think it was 43 executions. And that's just a lot to have in your head. And men are able to compartmentalize better than women. And so, like, he has locked away a lot of the trauma from that, which allows him to have a healthy mental state. But as he started writing that book, it all comes back to the surface, and then you have to deal with it all over again. So I definitely do not advise that writing a book that centers around tragedy is for everyone, because it can have long-reaching ramifications that you may not be willing to deal with as the author.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an over-under, because I consulted with Hollins, Rabin, and Weissman, and they were another law office that I'd worked with, and he was actually the attorney for the defense for the last person that was electrocuted in the state of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And it was such a fascinating find, because he had this PDF buried in the back end of his site, and I read him like, this is incredibly powerful stuff, and just having that first person perspective of, you know, being in that situation, and the words of the condemned coming forward, it's such powerful storytelling. But I could also tell when I brought it up, like, it was a sensitive subject. Like, yeah, I guess let's put that out there. That was pretty hard, but like, it was one of his most successful blog posts. You know, we posted it up to Reddit. They mostly latched onto the fact that the electric chair in Tennessee, called Old Sparky, was actually built from the wood of the gallows that they used to hang people from. So I'm like, that's like a direct gateway to hell right there. Like, well, taking the gallows, turning it into the electric chair, it's just insane. But it's that conversion of, you know, tragedy, you know, difficulty sometimes does make for good stories. But you're right, like, you got to be careful. Like, are you willing to walk those paths of trauma again to be able to relate?
And again and again.
because you're going to go through editing.
Talk about it.
Yeah. And then you're going to have to talk about your book, which is talking about it again.
Yeah.
So my first question is, like, what is the current status or process of actually getting published as an author? Because technically speaking, I'm an author, but it's only because I published something called, I self-published this SEO book, and all I got was this lousy knowledge panel on Google, a cynical ploy to exploit rankings and show the absurdity of SEO.
Yes.
That's the whole title. So there's definitely a big difference between, you know, going to Amazon, you've got a Google Doc, and it only needs to be, I think, 24 pages, and you can publish a book on Amazon. So what's the difference between that and, like, published, getting a book out there? What's the shape of the market right now? How does that work?
Well, so, very interesting question. And so to clarify, and this just really gets into, there is so much about the world of publishing. It is a multifaceted journey, depending on which direction you want to go with it. So I actually work with people who are starting their own publishing company. Now, you can call it self-publishing, but as you know from your own experience and hearing you talk about, well, I just self-published a book, I'm not really published, does that make me published? There are different ways to self-publish, right? There is that beginner journey. And, I mean, we all have to start somewhere, right? And Amazon makes it easy to put out a book. And that doesn't have to be a small feat. There are a lot of people that have self-published and use the print-on-demand platform and are extremely successful. And there are people that have done it without hiring professionals, like maybe they just used Canva, maybe they used Atticus for the interior, they watched some videos, got the book up there, because the important part was the content. They weren't really wanting to be a publisher, they just wanted to share their knowledge base. And I definitely see the bifurcation in the self-publishing industry between people who just want to share their content and they're not really concerned about following or learning the art of publishing versus the other end of the spectrum. The majority of my PitcherBook clients, they are starting a publishing business. They have multiple titles. They are investing $10,000 to $20,000 per title in every book, because what that includes is, there's so much. But breaking it down to the bulk line items, when a client is spending $20,000 on publishing a picture book, those bulk line items are obviously, one of those is going to be professional printing. And that is such a world of difference from what is on available on print on demand. Amazon's goal is to make the cheapest product for the most amount of revenue, right? And so they have put together it's not necessarily the cheapest product, but when you see a print-on-demand product next to a professionally printed product, you can tell the difference. I can spot the difference from at least 6 feet away, and I do it all the time at Barnes & Noble, because I'm like, oh, that's a print-on-demand book. It just has the cheap gloss coating or the cheap matte coating. You can just tell when you're an expert in the industry. But my clients that are doing is this my print proof? Let me check. Okay. So like this is, a picture book, which I love, called The Odd Dog. And this has it has spot UV. It has debossing on the cover. It's a 9x9. It has a linen cover with a foil here and here. It has the, self-ended pages here. You cannot get this with print-on-demand. When you open a print-on-demand book, it goes straight to white. You don't have an option to have those pattern pages. And then let me just take that off. Her illustrator cost was, I think, right at $6,000 for this book. My rate for my services, because I help her from beginning to end, which is a year-long journey, is $6,000. And we do another professional printing feature. Yes, this is what I love. It's called, and you're definitely not getting this on print on demand, is being able to do stuff like this with your books. And so this is called a double gatefold.
Like fold out.
And then, those are the bulk items that are involved with writing the book, getting the book edited, getting the book art directed, learning how to publish, hiring the illustrator, working with the illustrator for 6 to 9 months, dealing with a printer. And so self-publishing has evolved so that it can now rival what you see in the traditional publishing realm. And that's because we now have access to these printers. We now have, the internet, where we can tap into the knowledge base of how traditional publishing works, and we can replicate that in our own business. And you have access to crowdfunding. If you don't have $20,000, you can raise $20,000 or less. Not all books are $20,000, but when you're ordering 5,000 units and you're getting, just say, $3 a unit plus shipping, you're going to be in that $15,000 ballpark just for 5,000 printed units. And so you can see how that separates the people who are doing this as a business, who are investing in a physical product, versus people who just upload it and do a set it and forget it, because they did the thing they wanted to do, which was just share their knowledge. But with traditional publishing, you have to seek out and you have to write a pitch. You have to pitch your book to an agent. The agent has to select you, and then the agent has to pitch to the publishing houses that are in their network. And then it can be a 2-year and possibly longer process. And there have been times when you get that far and you've signed a contract, you've done these things, and then the publishing company doesn't ever even publish your book at all. They decide to, you know, set it on the back shelf and maybe they'll pick it up again. So it is a crazy world, this publishing thing.
So I'm curious, like, what do the margins in that industry that you're working with generally look like if you're investing, $6,000, $12,000, $15,000, and then, that's a three, like per item, that's $3. And then when the book hits the shelves, obviously that's at full retail. So, they would have bought it at half of that or so. Right. Like how does that math generally work out, and what's the potential return on investment from investing and taking your time to do this or join that industry to launch a book?
Yeah, great question. And that is one thing. It's going to, like, that's why it's best if you have more than one product. In any business, you want more than one SKU, if possible. You hear it on Shark Tank all the time. And I'm not saying that is, especially if the internet has proven anything, it is that there are exceptions to every rule. You can say something and someone's going to contradict it. But for the majority of business models, having multiple SKUs is what's going to help you with success, because it's going to keep you out in front of your audience. And so publishing for profit is a long game if you're doing the professional printing way of doing things. There are authors who make profit through print on demand because their audience is not necessarily concerned about the quality of the tactile product. But what you said is exactly right. Say your cost per unit just for that physical book production is, like I said, if you're printing 5,000 units and you can, depending on page count, depending on trim size, you can get your costs down. You can actually get it down way less than $3 if you, if you're willing to take on the extra work that it takes to get there, which is going direct to printer. In China, I want to add that as well. Everybody does have questions right now about how the printing industry is going to be impacted because of tariffs. So I think it is good to also mention that historically tariffs have not been applied to picture books. There is actually an organization that manages this, that goes to bat for the industry to keep tariffs at bay. Also, that is usually a part, like when you sign with a printer, say you sign, you get a quote that's good for 30 days. If the tariffs go up or down, or whatever shipping goes up or down, or whatever's going on, your quote is good for 30 days. And so if prices go up within that or down within that time frame, you're not going to take that hit or receive the lift either, because that's just part of the business game. But when you do, your goal is to produce the best product that you can produce for the lowest price point that you feel good about. I mean, the cheapest quote is never the best, as we know. Because you want a sellable product. You don't want one that's going to fall apart. And so, but just say your price per unit is $3. And then you're retailing this book, and I'll just use round numbers, $20. So you do have a $17 middle ground there to work with if you're selling it yourself, right? Instead of, you don't have to sell through a bookstore. A lot of people don't want to sell through a bookstore because they don't want the hassle that can be they would prefer to work their business themselves, to bootstrap it as much as possible, to run their own marketing, to sell their books to events, to schools, to colleges. There's a lot of picture book authors specifically. There's a whole model for selling your books to the school. Yes, you go and speak at the school. And I think, I mean, I grew up in public school. I homeschooled my own kids, but I grew up in public school. And we used to have authors come in, you know, magicians, all kinds of people would come in and do a showcase for us. And so now I know that model is they are guaranteed X amount of dollars to come in and make that. And that includes X number of copies of their book. So there are lots of different models besides just the wholesale model that bookstores operate off of. I know I didn't exactly answer that question, but I know I've been talking for a while.
No, you did. You did. But it's not a. It's not a, an exact number. It's more of an awareness of there is a space between the hard cost of the product itself, and then how it got, how it's the amount that it's sold on the shelf. So then there, it's fascinating. I never connected those dots of, oh, hey, we've got this author to come to speak with attached to, oh, they're going to buy a certain number of these books and put them on that shelf. That's, I always kind of had in mind of, I definitely knew that, you know, as an author, you know, you could go to bookstores and, you know, you do a signing. And I assumed that there was some amount of guarantee that that bookstore is going to carry X number of things, you know, it, as much as, you know, doing events to promote, you know, having, you know, your book launch, like having a party in and of itself, you know, having a, renting a photo booth for the event or whatever, is its own event marketing. But it's fascinating to know that there are these extra business models of ways to use print as a revenue stream. How has that evolved with the existence of search engines, with the access of the internet, the rise of social media, the existence of book talk, and social media? How does that online marketplace impact a physical product creation process of these books?
Yeah, I was so excited to do this interview because I listened to several of the podcasts. This is definitely my speed because, you know, we're just getting, the more you get to hear my answers, the more you can pose a question that can take it, keep taking us deeper into the process. And so there are, like, there's a lot of people that make books that never even make the physical product, right? They're just dialing in on Kindle books, on audio books, on selling PDFs through their website, and they never even print a book. You can sell a PDF that the person can print if they want to, kind of like a digital download on Etsy, right? Like, oh, you buy this art for $5. You can spend the $100 to print it and frame it on whatever paper and framer you want to use, versus, this art piece, this bottom art piece I just got from Mr. Watson Design. I don't know if you can see it. It's got a little bit of a glare on it. But this, like, I would never have thought to, I would never have wanted to download this and then pay to have it printed myself because it was too much work. And so he is still a physical creator as well, where he gets his prints printed and then ships to you, but he also has digital downloads, I believe, as well. So it is very interesting to see how people can take this industry and make it work for them, and that there is still a way to keep your investment down if you're not hell-bent on producing a physical book. That all of the platforms that are out there allow you to do that. And people get very creative, definitely.
Yeah, I think that one question that creeps into every conversation, whether it's SEO or digital marketing, is LLMs, AI-generated content. You know, we now have a stat of the online content is about 50% or so contaminated or created in some way by an AI-assisted tool or directly by it. Now, Google also has an interesting stat that about half of the pages that they crawl are actually spam. So there's a high confluence of artificially created content that is actually spam that is AI generated at the same time, intended just to rank. But there is a growing amount of content in the industry, in my industry, that is created through LLMs or ChatGPT. What has been the impact on the book creation process with the ubiquity of these new tools that can kind of step in and create content, write content? Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. What have you seen has been the reaction within the book world to these new tools?
Well, I am not a fan of AI myself. And so I attract people who do not want to use AI. They value the human experience, and AI, it's going to keep going. I get that. Too much has been put into it. Like, you couldn't stop the debit card. You couldn't stop, you know, the electricity. And these were good things. And so I do try to, you know, give myself those pep talks. It's just because I'm abhorrently opposed to it, I need to challenge myself and ask myself why. Ask myself what's the worst that could happen. And those are some interesting conversations, because we grew up with, you know, iRobot, all these shows. We know, like, we've seen the movies, my guy. This really, maybe I won't be alive to see it, but I do feel like we humans do have a tendency to, for all the good that we do, that there's other things that do the bad. And so when I come across AI generated content in groups, like there are different, you know, social media groups, Facebook groups, online communities, the creatives are usually, I would say 90% of the creatives are against it. And they are for a lot of different reasons. Some are afraid of it. You know, most of our reactions come down to fear. You know, humans, we are very fear-based. And so if we're opposed to something, it usually starts at the root of fear. And, you know, people are, I think most people are afraid, as we know, of losing their job to AI. And that's valid, because you, on the other side of things, you have people who are, they just want to usurp. Right? You look at Hollywood. You think Hollywood is taking care of the mental health of the actors and the people? And we know they're not. They don't care about you as a human. They just want to take what they can from you and make as much money off of you as possible. That is it. You are not a human to them. You are either an asset or a detriment, an expense. And so there's definitely that in all levels of humanity, including publishing. You have the publishers who value the creatives they work with, and then you have the publishers who just want the content. They don't care about their team members as humans. How much money are you going to make for me? And if you're not going to make any money for me, I will use AI. I don't have to care about its emotions. And so, which is true. I see it all the time. And I'm just doing what I can to stand my ground. I work with traditional artists. I work with oil painters, watercolorists, acrylic artists, as well as digital artists. And I have a no AI policy myself. And I don't want to work with someone who wants to feed that machine. But, you know, we'll see where I'm at in 5 years. I've changed my mind before. But this is how I feel right now, and that is definitely what I'm seeing in the artist communities as well. I don't see a lot of authors standing up for the creatives, and that is what bothers me, right? We need more than just the creatives speaking out against the use of AI, because the authors and the publishers are the ones that are making these long-term decisions to embrace AI or to embrace humanity.
That very well reasoned. I think in the SEO industry, we tend to be early adopters. I know I worked with somebody who was using an LLM-based model in 2014. Buddy, I'm recording a show. Use the other bathroom. In as early as 2014, he was creating a lot of his content with the early versions. It was not Jasper. It was Jarvis was the earliest LLM model.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been out there for over 10 years. So, you know, I've seen it for so long and kind of like, okay, it can do these things. It's just funny to see in the past 2 years, oh, GPT, like, this is a brand new thing. And it just entered the public zeitgeist attached to a particular, you know, brand of, oh, GPT can do this, GPT that. But there is kind of a degradation of the industry in general because of outputs of LLMs, and also a misunderstanding of exactly what's happening, because it's literally just making up the next word in the sentence based off of probability and math and what it's been trained on. It's a fantastic liar.
It's really a cool tech.
It's really cool, but if you go at it as, oh, this is data from Star Trek, and he's giving me a reasoned answer based off of his neural network. Nope. It's a process. It's a math process of lying. Like, it's lying really effectively, but it doesn't truly know things. Like, that's down the road, once these machines actually know something, that's another terrifying concept written about by Asimov and Frank Herbert and many other science fiction writers of when we cross that boundary. But I think there is both an appreciation culture of people who don't want content that's written by machines to like fake things. Mm-hmm. And a boutique industry, like, I think there will be a day where we get organic certified content, like organic certified beef.
That's a good point. Yes.
Of like, you know, they'll have like a certification program or a monitor that watches you. Like, you either do it on video or it's recorded.
That's kind of scary. Like,
in a way, but it's also like, it's going to become necessary at some point to prove the humanity of the process.
Yes.
Of like, you know, digitally signing that this, you know, either, you know, it could be maybe a program where there's no possibility that AI can be used to input into it, like, you know, like certified keyboards that you type into that, you know, fingerprint match as you go along and tokenize as you write, proving your humanity, or it's attached to a heartbeat meter. I don't know. Well, there's all kinds of things that happen in my head, but the concept being, there is, like in podcasting, like, this is a conversation, you know, expertise, authority, and trust is communicated through one-on-one connection versus, you know, if I went to Claude and asked it, hey, what does the book publishing industry look like right now? I might get a sample of some of this information, but certainly not, you know, a display of a particular book that was created, insight of from a particular print that occurred. There isn't experiential information within these systems. And so I think there are places where it can be used. I certainly use some LLM tools to help process some of the content that I create, but I'm leaning towards, you know, genuine conversations, podcasts being more of the source of truth, and then finding ways to surface and utilize direct quotes and then augment that content creation with a smart adaptation of these uses. Because there are things where you can create a house using only tools from the 12th century, but it will be very expensive, very laborious, and probably a little bit more drafty than if you used modern processes and modern materials. So there is kind of a give and take adaptation as technology comes in, but there are causes and places to truly just value the written word as written by humans for humans.
Yes. Is this the part you tell me you're really a robot?
I am a robot. My wife questions sometimes, you know, like whether I am sent from another planet or programmed appropriately. Usually when I malfunction and don't remember to take out the trash again,
she questions my programming. I mean, it's my husband's job as well, and we definitely are traditional in our roles, although we all do our own laundry. That's one thing. And like I told you, we homeschooled our kids. My kids were doing their own laundry by the time they were 6 or 7. Like, we all do our own laundry. I don't have time. You do your own dishes. Like, but my husband does take out the trash. what do I do? I decorate. I do that. I garden. I was going to say too, like, I am such a holdout on the technology. Like, I don't use fingerprint. I don't use any biometrics. I will not scan my face. I ain't scanning my eyeballs, my face. Nobody's getting my fingerprints unless I commit a crime. Like, right. You know, it's all of these things. Like, that is how much of a holdout I am. However, I love that I can work from home in my pajamas using the internet, right? Using the technology that it has been created and is being, possibly AI is being used to help create the technology that benefits me. And so it's kind of like how you can only boycott so much. My daughter is a vegan. I was like, that is the most teenager thing you've ever done in your life. But I mean, she's like, but you know, the animals. I'm like, yes, I do understand. I understand. And that's why we locally source, we have our own chickens. I know how these chickens are being treated. I'm eating that egg, you know? But I'm like, well, what about the phone you use? What about your iPad? You know, that's made by slave labor more than likely in non-American countries. You know, so, you know, I'm all about the discussion and the debate. But at the end of the day,
there has to be functionality.
Yes, yes. And you have to, you can't be scared of everything. What was it? Don't be so open-minded your brains fall out. That's kind of like how I try to live life. And don't be so close-minded either. So for me, it's all about striking a balance. As of right now, I don't use AI. I don't see the benefit of it. Like, I turned off Copilot on my machine. I don't even like to use autocorrect because I feel that dumbs us down. We've actually stopped using maps on our phones because we realized we don't know how to get anywhere without using maps. But we used to get places by turning left at the second gas station, you know? And so I love these types of dialogues because this is where you get into the good stuff. I know it's not necessarily about publishing, but when you asked me at the beginning, you know, why can someone trust you? I always try to be my most authentic self so that those who are looking for me can find me. And that is hopefully establishing that trust. When people see those things in me, oh, I relate, or I can appreciate, or I can respect, then that is where the trust is built. And pretty much all of my business is referrals. I do have a website. I do, you know, marketing. I'm doing podcasts and stuff. But the majority of my business has always been and will always be referrals because it's a personal experience. You work with me. I'm not a book mill. I'm not subbing work out to people you don't know whose faces you can't see. Like, you hire me, you get me. You get the Melinda experience. So hold on to your hats.
Yeah, I love that. So as we wrap up, why don't you go ahead and throw out your domain name and if there's any social media channels people can interact with you specifically, and a final thought on why? Why would they go down this path? What's in it for them?
So my website is melindamartin.me. I am looking at rebranding to Tibbington Publishing Studio. So that may be something people see. If they go to my website, they may get redirected to Tibbington Publishing Studio. I have made a decision to not really be on social media because it's such a time thief. And so what I'm doing instead, what I am focusing on, I guess YouTube is kind of social media, but I see it more of a learning platform than traditional social media. So I'm just trying to share my content right now through YouTube because it's a great place for people who are wondering, what does Melinda know? Should I work with her? Am I a good fit? They can kind of go see, watch some of my long form videos that get into why I make the decisions that I do, what's important to me about a book, and then hopefully schedule a fit call, which is the next step to see if we would work well together. And then why people would do this is a lot of my clients are doing it, my picture book clients specifically, because they want to make a difference. They were impacted by picture books as a child. That is, I'm the middle child of a large family. Not that my parents did not love me. They took very good care of me. They loved me. They did these things. But when you have a large family, something's getting dropped, especially when both the parents work full-time jobs. And so I was the middle child who was often, you know, go and play, go read a book, go keep yourself busy while we take your brothers and sisters to sports and dancing and, you know, ballet class. You didn't make the cut. Sorry. I don't know exactly what happened there, but I mean, I'm not athletic, so it's okay. But picture books were a world for me to dive into before the internet, right before cable TV. I was born in 77. And so picture books really formed my worldview. And I had some great picture books. And so the majority of the authors I'm working with now, they are just wanting to make that same impact that picture books had on them. And whether that's about learning how to rescue a dog or being a mermaid. One of my clients, she is a professional mermaid, and her book is involves that, you know, just showing kids that you don't always have to do the traditional route. You can do other things, and beekeeping, like people that want to educate. Like, I love to educate, and I attract people who share the same passions. So that would be, at the end of the day, why most people do what they do, is to be the good.
Absolutely love that. Thank you so much for your time. It was a fantastic experience.
Was it? I hope so.
All right. We'll see you around.
All right. Thank you, Jeremy.